coming today. How many retailers do we have in the audience? All right. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and start this off on a personal note. So in my career at comics, I've had many, many moments that I consider to be high points. And as a kid who kept reading comics because of Dark Horse Presents, and spent a good chunk of my adolescence reading the bullpen bulletin, being up here with Mike Richardson, president of Dark Horse, and Jim Shooter, is definitely one of those moments. So, without further ado, and with that being said, I'm going to go ahead and let these gentlemen to my right introduce themselves.
I'm Dennis Calera. I'm Dennis Calera. You know, I don't really need it. Right. I'm Dennis Calero, and I'm going to be the artist and colorist on Solar.
I'm Jim Shooter, and I'm, I guess I'm sort of the head writer for these redevelopments of Magnus Robot Fighter, Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom, and several to come, which we'll talk about later. And thank you.
I'm Chris Warner, senior editor at Dark Horse. I'm editing the line that, that we're talking about here, and I'm the shortest guy on the panel. So I'm here for scale for Jim to get a better idea of how tall he actually is.
I'm Bill Reinhold, and I'm doing the art on Magnus Robot Fighter. I'm doing pencils and inks.
All right, with that being said, I'm going to go ahead and start this off by asking Jim. Jim, how did you come to be a part of this project, and what are your visions for it going forward?
Well, if you know my history, I've worked at Marvel, and then after that I started a company called Valiant, and we got the rights for these same basic group of characters. At that time, it was from a company called Western Publishing. And I did it once before. I redeveloped Magnus Robot Fighter, Dr. Solar Man of the Atom, Turok Son of Stone. We had others, you know, in line, but I never got that far. And they did pretty well, and for a while. After I left, I'm not so sure. But at any rate, eventually they faded away. And Mike Richardson, one of my heroes, who had always wanted to get the rights to those characters, so the legend goes. In fact, I happen to know that he was actually asking Western for those rights about the same time that I had just managed to secure them. Anyway, so as things go around, Mike eventually acquired the rights. And for about 3 years, actually, we talked on and off about, you know, hey, would you like to do it again, Jim? And yeah, I would. One thing and another, he was busy. I was busy. It just kind of never happened. And then things all sort of came together just before the San Diego convention last year. I needed a gig. He was ready to go and ready to focus on it. He had tremendous ideas. And we just started, you know, cooking it up. And next thing you know, I was on stage at San Diego, you know, being announced by Mike. And like I say, I'm sort of going to coordinate the whole thing and kind of guide it, I guess. And then with great help from senior editor Chris Warner, who really does all the hard work. And Mike, whose interest in this has made it really made it, you know, significant, and has really helped us. Anyway, I think that, you know, it's really exciting project for me. It's very hard because I've done it before, and Mike said to me, "Don't do it the same. Do it. I want it all new." And so I had to put all that out of my mind and start all over. And the good news about that is it forced me to rethink everything and maybe do things that, you know, maybe a little smarter this time. So he said, be true to the characters, but, you know, make it rock in a new way. And with these guys' help, I think that, you know, we've made steps toward that. I hope we have. You'll tell us.
And Dennis, being the artist on Solar, what's your connection to the character? Had you read the original Gold Key material or any of the Valiant material before?
No, I hadn't actually read any of the Gold Key stuff. My first experience with Solar was actually interning for Jim at Valiant a number of years ago. And seeing everything go from doing the video game comics to launching Magnus and Rye, and then Solar, and then slowly all these other titles emerged.
Look how little Dennis has grown.
Just about the same height. And watching how everything came together in unity, and finding out that that Torque was the was Magnus's father, and just being like, oh my God, did you plan that? And Jim's just like, I'm like, liar.
I planned everything.
He planned everything. Valiant was, as a place of business, was sort of my first real exposure of how comics can be a really fun and interesting and torturous and engaging, you know, on a daily basis kind of business that I wanted to be a part of. I was actually studying architecture in school. And then 1 year away from a five-year degree that would have let me get my license, I decided to switch over to illustration and pursue this. And riches were bestowed upon me. So
then he woke up.
Yeah. So.
And Bill, down at the end, the same question for you in terms of your relation to Magnus before this project.
Well, I had read some of the Valiant, of Jim's Valiant work. But not much, just a few issues. I looked at a lot of stuff. And the early work, the Gold Key work, that work I only caught up through the years when people would point out Russ Manning's artwork on it and said, you know, oh, look at this guy's stuff. You know, it's really good. And so that's how I got to know it. And also because one of my friends, Steve Rude, who is known for being similar or very influenced by that artist, that also got me to know the character somewhat, but otherwise I've really just been studying it now and looking back at the history. I've got the collection of the Gold Key books, which are really interesting, and then also I've been looking at the old Valiant stuff too, and just it's just interesting to see the different views on it and where we're trying to take it now, and I'm just excited about it in general because of the whole, you might say, universe of Magnus Robot Fighter, this, you know, this futuristic universe with so many levels of possibilities. It's really, you could do so much with it, and so it just really fills my imagination.
But just to reiterate, this is all new. It has nothing to do with the Valiant universe. I'm glad that Bill's interested to see which direction we took that, but we're not following that.
Yeah, just as a curiosity, yeah. I'm looking back.
Not that I didn't like it.
Yeah. Although, let's be honest, I mean, a guy who fights robots is really a timeless character.
Yeah.
I'm always good with a guy who fights robots.
Can't get that wrong.
Yeah. For some people, that's all you need to know. Magnus Robot Fighter. He smashes
exactly.
Robots.
You know, and for me, it's Back to the Future, you know, I mean.
And so Chris, for you, how about, in terms of like these characters, like other characters, did you read a lot of that stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, I'm old enough to have actually bought Dr. Solar books off the stands when I was a kid, and I was kind of obsessed with the whole atomic thing. And like, I was like 8 years old or whatever, and just the idea of Man of the Atom, and it just didn't look. Also, I love the Gold Key books because they had painted covers.
Yeah.
And they just didn't look like any other books out there. And I'm just like, God, these are just so different. And so it's great to be able to kind of, you know, reconnect with that sort of excitement. And yet, in a different context now, and just to kind of regrow these classic characters. Because, I mean, when I think of comics, there are only a handful of really iconic characters. I mean, so many of the other characters are sort of a little of this character and a little of that. But Magnus and Solar and Turok, these are, I mean, there was nothing like them before, and I still think that they still have that feel of, you know, really representing different things, very, very clear-cut, the looks of the characters. I mean, I remember seeing, I think the first time I saw Dr. Solar, just that red costume and that visor, and I just thought, God, this is just so cool. It's just so straightforward, and I remember, seeing Turok covers, and just as a kid, I was just like freaking out. I mean, it was like, dinosaurs and with a guy with a bow and arrow. I'm thinking this is probably not a good idea, but knock yourself out. But I'm just so excited to be part of that. And to me, the great thing too was wanting to bring that cover feel as well. That those painted covers and But to bring them, you know, artists who are a little more contemporary, but still, because I mean, some of the guys who did those covers were, I mean, were top-notch illustrators. I mean, they were, you know, classic illustrators. And it's great that we've also got the archive books out, and just getting a chance to flip through and see all those covers that just knocked me out when I was a kid, and they're still strong. And I, you know, just to, so in a sense, I like the fact that we're relaunching and reinventing these in some ways, but also not throwing away what I thought was so special about those characters and, you know, what they are and how they looked and the feel of those books. So I, it's great to be, you know, to kind of be part of that that history of the characters now.
Well,
to be
the thing I like about the Magnus book, the character and how it's been done in the past. If you look at when it first started, it was done sort of through the view of the future in the 60s, the way people saw the future. And when it was done in the 80s, if you look back at it now, you can see it was the cutting edge at that time. Whatever was going on, hairstyles, this, that, whatever was cutting edge. So now, you can still stay true to the characters, but you try and put that cutting edge on it of today's view.
And beyond. I think at this point, we've finally gotten to the point where we see the syndrome that Bill is talking about, thanks to Bill. And we're sort of militating against it. We're trying to think into the future and not be constrained by this decade.
That's the challenge.
By the way, old enough to have bought Magnus and Solar, and young enough to have worked at Marvel Comics when I was there and he was a pup.
Yeah, this is very strange. He was my, you know, first boss in comics, and my next boss was even taller than him, Mike Richardson. So.
A boss I can look up to.
Yeah,
at last.
If Shaquille O'Neal ever starts a comics company, I think I'm well set to go work for him. So,
actually, on the same topic, Chris, if you could talk a little bit about the cover artists who are working on these books.
Yeah, we have Raymond Swanland, who is doing the Magnus covers, and I first saw his work. This is my secret shame. I still play Magic the Gathering. Oh my God! But and I was getting ready to do Aliens and Predator and Aliens versus Predator relaunches, and I'd seen his work on a couple of trading cards, and it was these really gnarly sort of like goblins in this just crazy sharp rusted armor and just incredible action. And he'd never worked in comics, and I just got in touch with him, and you know, and I, of course. Getting a chance to have my age shoved back in my face, he was like, "Oh yeah, you know, I love Predator, man. Back when you were drawing Predator in the 80s, and I was 12, it was one of my favorite books, and it kind of got me involved." And I was like, "Well, thank you so much for bringing that up." And then Michael Komark, who's when we got to doing these books, and I, you know, thought, you know, I've got to have Raymond on these books because he's so professional and a great guy. And his stuff just every time he. Send something in. And I've been in the business for a long time, but I'm one of those people. Those covers come in, and I'm just like running around the office, going, "Look, this is awesome." And Michael Komark was another guy I saw on a Magic card, and I checked his site out, and it was just his work was just incredible. But it also reminded me in some ways of the kind of classic illustration painting. Of this era of Solar and Magnus that I'd seen, but much very modern. He paints digitally, and I just saw his work, and it was just everything he did. And particularly, I think what struck me in terms of Solar was he did a couple of pieces of, and it was a magician or a wizard or something, and it was like this energy crackling between his hands, but just the lighting and the dynamics of it were just astonishing, and I just immediately thought of Solar and with this energy crackling, and that's what the first cover, that's what we got. And
so he emails me some samples of these two gentlemen's work. He says, "Hey, Jim, what do you think of these guys for doing the covers?" I'm like, "What do I think? You know, it's like, you know, that'll do, pig. I don't know. It was awesome. I've never seen work like this before. It's really like an honor to have these guys doing the covers."
Well, now Michael Komark also is someone who's never worked in comics. I mean, both of these guys have done tons of work in gaming, book covers, game design, you name it. But they were comics fans. As a matter of fact, Michael had told me, he goes, "Oh yeah, when I was a kid, my dad used to, you know, his father was a comics fan, and some of his favorite stuff was Dr. Solar and Magnus. So he remembered these and." Even though he had not been looking for work in comics, he just thought, "God, that would really be fun, you know, to to do this. And of course, the first thing he turns in is just like mind blowing. So, yeah, so really exciting.
I think it's great to bring talent from outside because too many people who are only in comics, it kind of feeds on itself, and you get a lot of the same interpretations. Where I think you've got something really fresh.
Does this mic work? Does it help at all?
Yeah, it does.
I can't hear it. No, I agree with that. I think that, you know, getting some fresh perspective is always good. I mean, I work at that myself, even though I've been in comics forever. I keep trying to back away from myself and look at everything as if I've never seen it before, as if I were just a reader picking it up. And it took me a long time to be able to do that, sort of out-of-body experience thing. But you have to be able to do that, or else you're just going to keep repeating the same stuff. And our goal is not to repeat the same stuff. Our goal is to break new ground and create books that does everybody here do what I do? You make a little stack of comics to read, and then you put them in, kind of in order, which ones to read. Yeah, okay, all right, everybody does that. We want to be on the top of that stack. We absolutely want to be, no question, read us first. And have to argue with yourself about which one to read first. That's the goal. And, somebody else talk.
Well, I'm actually going to show a couple pages from these books now. Bill, I'm going to start with you, if you can kind of talk a little bit about just sort of what you view as kind of the challenges of making Magnus the kind of character that is going to really appeal to a modern comics audience, and then also just in general, kind of what you were thinking about when you took on this task and drew these pages.
Well, in a lot of ways, with this story, I think we were touching on the classic with some of the look and feel of the robots and such, and we're branching off into other things too besides that. And which I actually had a lot of fun doing. I mean, because I really like a lot of designs from the old stuff. But the challenge is I guess it's, I don't know if I'd call it a challenge as much as an enjoyment of dealing with these characters and like the kinds of scenes of the futuristic city and the robots and trying to decide how many pieces they're going to break up into when you smash them. I don't know. It's just fun to do. Like that top panel there. I mean, I was just trying to get a whole movement going across. From, I mean, you've got like where Magnus kicks the center image of the robot, and that it's causing the other robot to lose his balance and everything. Of course, a lot of this was Jim's script, but I was trying to get this across, this kind of movement and feel to it. And so with the action scenes like this, I'm trying to get this flow of movement to things. I don't know, it's almost like a wave sometimes, you might say. And so that it's when you get, in a way, when you're working with these characters that are not human, you get to do things that you might not do with humans. I mean, if these were real people, this would be, you'd have to rate this book differently. So you just get to have so much fun with all the energy to it. So.
And when the bad guys bleed lubricant, it doesn't really gross anybody out.
Then you just slip on that. That's about it. Yeah.
It was actually very interesting in this story. I mean, again, the robots look like robots, but these are artificial intelligences, and they have they have personalities, and they have
some of them do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and so that can, it's sort of an interesting contrast where you look at a robot and you think, this is what it is, and then you realize that maybe it's not quite what you think, and you find, I found myself emotionally kind of being pulled in a unusual, it was a part of the story that was actually uncomfortable, is not the word I'm looking for, but where I kind of like, the emotional space that I was in was sort of unfamiliar where you think the story is going.
So yes, it worked.
That's good writing. I mean, Jim's scripts are incredible. I mean, they're some of the most, I mean, I've worked with a lot of scripts over the years, but they are so well thought through, and Jim has a lot of, you know, science background in his writing, and it's great. I mean, you know, from having drawn a lot of comics myself over the years, to actually have a script where the reference material is embedded within the script, and so, you know, Jim has an idea and you see it, and then it's, you know, where you know that every shot has been considered really well and really thought through, and how each panel flows into the next one, and everything that you need to be set up 2 pages later or 4 panels later is, you know, clearly described before. And Jim can come up with some very challenging, you know, things for an artist to construct from those things. But I think that as an artist, to be able to see the writer thinking through this, you know, thinking through it visually. A lot of writers, I think, as they're writing scripts, it's like there's a movie running in their head of what they're writing, and so they're not thinking about this picture followed by this picture. They have sort of like a, you know, a running thing going, and Jim really does think that through in a way that I don't think every writer does, and it's really great to see.
Just to finish that off, I actually do a little scribble sketch of every panel just to make sure it can be drawn. You know, sloppy little scribbles, but just to kind of figure it out in my head, and also to think about, all right, how is this going to segue into the next panel, or what is the greatest logical leap I can make from this panel to this panel where everyone's minds fill in the in-betweens. We used to call that Kirby pacing. Kirby, you know, the shots were different, but it was easy to fill in the in-betweens in your mind. You never said, well, wait a minute, where'd that come from, you know? And so anybody who knows me and knows my stuff, you know, I'm all about clarity. And a lot of people take that to mean simplicity, and that's not true. I think that you can be very complex in your story and in your art as long as you're clear and as long as you tell it well. I hope to make very complex and interesting stories that are just rich and deep, you know, and who knows, maybe I get lucky one day and it'll actually happen. But that's what I'm trying for, and that's what I'm demanding of these guys in the art, is to make it, you know, like clear at a glance, but rich and deep details. I often make fun of myself in my scripts of, you know, that's a detail, but details are important to me. And you know, I'm not easy to work with, so I'm trying to get a little better at, you know, being able, you know, relating in, you know, more clearly to them, and you know, and I think that as we go along, we'll all get better at it, and get better at working together, and that's, you know, I haven't seen much of the art yet. I saw one of the Free Comic Book Day books and flipped through it and said, "Ooh, look, it's colored." I feel like I'm with some really talented people here, and him, especially a talented editor. And, you know, I think that I told you what our goal was, and I guarantee you that we're going to give it our best shot.
Well, something else I want to point out, too, just quickly. When I was first working at Marvel, and this was, you know, at the time most new artists were living you pretty much had to live in the New York area. And one of the things that Jim would do, and I was living with a guy named Mark Badger, who was also breaking in at the same time, and once you started getting work at Marvel, Jim would bring you in and give you what he called the 50-cent storytelling lecture, which was, because comics were 50 cents, now it would be about a $4.95 lecture. And he would sit down with an issue of Fantastic Four that Jack Kirby had drawn. He would go through, it took about 45 minutes, he would go through the entire book and explain visual storytelling. And even, like, I had a pretty good knack for visual storytelling. I think that my drawing probably could have been better, but my storytelling was pretty good, and I think that's what kind of got me in the door. But it was just Jim's fundamental understanding of how you know, pictures relate and where your eye is going, and you know, again, like, where did he come from, and where is he going, and did you establish the door, and, you know, and all these things were just so... And both of us were not, you know, both Mark and I, Mark Badger and I, were very different artists and had very different ways of looking at things. And both of us came out of there just going, like, wow, that's really...
All this stuff beaten into my head after years and years and years working with Stanley and other really, really great people. I was just passing on the wisdom of the ancients. I didn't invent any of this. I think it's Dennis's turn to talk.
Yeah, I was actually just about to say...
I don't hear that often.
we're going to get into some of Dennis's pages here. Dennis, if you want to talk about a little bit about, you know, the process for you and kind of what direction you sort of saw these characters going in from your perspective as well.
Well, to me, clearly what Jim is doing with Solar is creating a science fiction epic. So the approach for me is, you know, this is a science fiction story where some of the people happen to wear costumes and we have some of the tropes of the superhero genre, but...
There's a reason for the costumes. Nobody does anything just randomly.
Right. So it's, to me, my approach is to sort of try to present the stuff. There may be a negative connotation to this word, but I don't mean it that way. Sort of clinically, like sort of just to show, to sort of, how would it be if you were standing on the street outside of a pizza place and a guy in a red costume was floating and beating on some hulking monster? Like, what would that feel like? For me, there's a sort of level of strangeness and oddness that I'm trying to bring to it, as well as wonder and fantasticness. And working with Jim's scripts are very dense, and all the information that you want is there, and it's also presented in a very clear, accessible way, so that I'm actually entertained while I'm reading the script, which is, trust me, is not par for the course for reading scripts. A script can still do everything it needs to do to give you what you need to illustrate it, and be very much just a sort of a pure blueprint. But it's you know, that's work. And to his credit, Jim's scripts are very entertaining. And I think in their entertaining you, he's also showing you what it is that the reader will find entertaining about this page, and what to bring forward and what to push back in terms of, you know, a hierarchy of images and what's important. So I'm just having a lot of fun with that.
And actually, to that point, Jim, I was going to ask you, when you're kind of reinventing these characters who had previous lifetimes and previous identities in your head, I mean, what's that process like? Do you feel?
What I try to do is if I have as Chris said, these are iconic characters. If I have iconic characters, I try to think about, well, what do most people know about these characters? And, you know, anyone who's familiar with them, what would they know? What would they remember? What is the essence of this character? Now, if I had 100 people who had read Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom in the 60s, and I asked them questions, what answers would I get? Well, you'd obviously, you know, some guy in some sort of nuclear or thermonuclear accident, all right, in an atomic accident back then, becomes basically radioactive and then slowly learns to use this radioactivity to accomplish heroic things. And I mean, they might name, oh yeah, there was Gail Sanders, that was the woman he was in love with, and there was a Dr. Clarkson, he was the boss, and oh, and it was in Adam Valley. And they probably wouldn't remember the kind of car that Dr. Solar drove, and which was what, the Jaguar? I don't know. I don't remember. Anyway, the thing is, they probably wouldn't remember some of those details. To me, anything that is the essence of the character, that people remember, that's you keep that. Little details around the edges, you know, that you can change those. You don't have to, and you only change them if it makes it better. Well, but for instance, with Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom, the origin is actually takes place in a zero issue, which is not even, we haven't even figured out how we're going to deploy that yet. It's all written. But the thing is, okay, we can't have him, you know, walk into an atomic pile anymore. I mean, that was old science back in even 63, when this, or 62 or whatever it was, when this started. So it's got to be something thermonuclear, obviously, to justify all of the things that this man can do. And so I was forced to actually invent a new way to build a fusion reactor. And I had lunch with him after. He says, I think that would work. And he's, you know, he's pretty hip to this stuff too. So anyway, I mean, but that's it. I spent a lot of time doing research about this stuff and trying to take that detail that could be changed, the atomic pile, and make it work in a new way that no one had ever seen before. I guarantee you, you've never seen anything like this before. And so I went through that logic with each character, trying to figure out Like, I mean, for instance, can anyone here tell me what tribe Turok was from in his original incarnation? Can anyone? Okay, it was Kiowa. Okay, how does a Kiowa know how to fish? Apaches don't eat fish. You know, and yet Turok teaches Andar to fish, and Andar, who's obviously also an Apache, eats the fish. Okay, those are details. I can fix that. Okay? I did. And I kind of created the justification for why Turok knows so much. He's traveled a lot, and he's seen a lot of things. And he is capable, therefore, of teaching the young boy things that he doesn't know. And so I worked that detail out in my mind to make Turok credible to me. I have no problem with Gaylord Dubois. You know, I mean, I thought he did a tremendous act of creation, and the only way I can honor it is to try to stay true to the essence and maybe clean up a few little things, and that's what we're doing. And I ask Mike. You know, he was tapping his foot, waiting for me to get this stuff in. Where is it? It's because I had a tremendous amount of research to do, and I wanted to get it right. This is the time I will nail this thing, okay? And bear with us and check it out.
Well, I wanted to mention too. There's kind of an interesting aspect to Jim's process on Magnus and Solar. He was talking about the zero issue, and this was something that I'd never seen done before, and it was really an interesting way of going about things. And I think it makes a lot of sense. Is that you know. Back in the day, every first issue was always an origin story. And I think that sometimes that works. I think sometimes, though, an origin story right off the bat can sort of, you know, you what it takes to get to be from, you know, dude to super dude, sometimes is not the most interesting way to start a story. I mean, I'm sometimes starting in the middle of an action of the character in costume and who they are often to me is a more dynamic way to start a story. And Jim, I think, understands that as well. But the first thing he does is he writes an origin story. Now, it's not going to be the first, it won't necessarily be the first book, but so, and I've actually seen, and I've worked on books before, where the writer was not going to tell the origin right away. And the writer would like never tell the origin, and the origin of the character as the character went along sort of became gassier and more complicated when you finally told it. So Jim already has, you know, he understands the origin, the essence, and the basics of the character and how they came to be very clearly, and knowing that from day one, he can then write a story that takes, you know, start the series with a story that takes place down the line, but never loses that key thread of how the character came to be. And so when the origin rolls out, I think it works much better. And I was really interested in seeing that.
And also, in that first issue, give you enough of a sense of how this came to be so that you're not entering a Swedish movie with no subtitles. I mean, the idea is to you know, not only like give you enough of an understanding of the character and how he got that way, but in a way, that sort of, I hope, sets up an intrigue that when we finally do that zero issue, in whatever form Dark Horse chooses to do it, that people will be looking for it and say, oh, yeah, I see. Now that's how that came about. That was alluded to, and now I see it all played out. And that helps to make it more interesting, that the, you know, a story that perhaps for many pages does not have the character in costume. So that's a theory. Once again, you'll tell us.
All right, so we've got about 20 minutes left, so I figured I was going to open it up to questions now. I'm sure that everybody in here has a few things to say.
You plan on keeping all these as standalone titles, or are you looking to form some kind of universe between them in some way?
You know, I mean, pretty much, unless I'm asked to write something that takes place, you know, in the Land of Oz, pretty much the stories I write are generally set on Earth. And so Turok is set on Earth, at least when it starts. Of course, he ends up sort of in a lost land, as everyone knows. Dr. Solar is set in present day Earth. Turok is set way in the past. Dr. Solar is set in present day Earth. And Magnus Robot's Fighter is set on Earth in the year 4000. is it a universe? I mean, is it a shared universe? In the sense that you and I live in a shared universe with Alexander the Great, yes. And, you know, and is it possible that Alexander the Great did something that affects us to this day? Sure. You know, so maybe maybe something that Solar does, you know, turns up, you know, in Magnus's time. But I mean, that's, to me, I'm just, it, to me, it's about making each one fulfill its destiny, fulfill its potential. And then, you know, logical connections when there are logical connections to be had. It's just all on Earth. It's a timeline that exists on Earth, I suppose you'd say. That's it. I mean, what comes from there, I don't know. I mean, that'll be, you know, Mike, who is a fountain of ideas. Sometimes I wish I could just, you know, put my earmuffs on. But, you know, Mike and I will talk all the time, and he has some great thoughts. And between me and him and Chris and the guys who you know, are, as you can see, are not quiet, retiring types, we'll figure it out. And we'll do, I think, what is we'll suss out what is best for the properties, for the books, and you know, try to deliver that in the best possible way, so that fans, and we are fans, and you are fans, and the retailers are fans, and we're all fans in this business, so that all of us enjoy it. Thank you.
As a fan, I'm thrilled that I get to read the stuff before you guys do. It's gonna be really cool.
My scripts are long.
That's true.
You back there?
Will you be using this as like you did with Valiant to kick off other original Dark Horse only superheroes, or bring back original Dark Horse heroes that are just like X, Vortex, Ghost, Barbar, well, Mask, and just supposed to be more for?
Let's just say that. Watch.
Because Dark Horse has this, although they're licensed property, are you involved in
the company we're working with is Classic Media, and they have a number of properties that we work with, and we need things such as Blue Lulu that comes from them. We are enhancing our partnership with them, and we're looking at maybe not specifically
expect a little Lulu Solar throwdown. And don't count her out. She's small, but she's feisty.
Are we here?
First comment, thank you for publishing Little Lulu. It's the best thing that's available nowadays. My question is, as far as the marketing of these books, as a fan and consumer, I'm asking you, please don't do stuff like send away issues.
Gotcha. Okay. He said, please don't do any of this promotional stuff like, you know, mailing your coupons and stuff like that. When we did that back at Valiant, the only thing I can say in our defense is that we never made a dime on any of that stuff. It was all free. You know, we gave it away. Even when we did foil covers and stuff, we gave them to the retailers. It was like a retailer getting a gold record because my evil partner happened to be from the music industry. And of course, that doesn't redeem us. I mean, dealers put them up on the walls and sold them for lots of money and stuff. And it wasn't a good idea. And I'll tell you one thing about Dark Horse. It's the classiest outfit I've ever, ever had any contact with, especially in this business. And I think you can expect the high road on everything from these guys. I don't think, you know, nothing else would be tolerated.
Well, actually, even back in the day, you know, during all this sort of, you know, crazy cover enhancement stuff, when most of the time when we would do it, we wouldn't tell anybody we were doing it. We would just, you know, we didn't...
Surprise!
We just wanted to us, I mean, again, this is a fun business, and, you know, you can't put too much fun in it. And when it becomes too much of a business, and when everything is sort of like, you know, financial calculus, it kind of bleeds the what makes this stuff special and fun, you know, is fun. And
yeah, I mean, remember,
fun is the best thing to have.
One more in my defense. I mean, remember when we did the black cover, they were all black. It wasn't like some special variant. They were all black. Every one of them.
I just thought that stuff was cool. I was there when all this stuff was coming out, and I just thought that, and maybe it was because I was physically there watching people, you know, the ideas weren't, I mean, I can tell you I was there. The ideas weren't generated because, hey, this would be cool, and we'll make a lot of money doing this. It was because, like, hey, wouldn't it be a day if the last, you know, if the 10th Solar cover in which the universe, you know, gets swallowed into a black hole was just black, and then wouldn't it be funny if Barry's signature was on the bottom? Because I mean, it's a black cover. He designed it. It was his decision.
And
so
I paid him for it.
full price.
Full rate. So I paid him for a cover sketch. He faxed it to me. It was a black square.
Thus, issues 10 through 15 will be all the black, blue, white, yellow, and red covers. And I'm going to work on those very hard, just for you, for all of you. And I'll sign them.
In black.
In black.
There's a question.
I have a question for Mr. Shooter. It's kind of funny, this came
That's
up.
That's Senor Shooter.
A friend of mine recently told me that because these comic book characters, just in general, are so old, it's hard to come up with original stories. Asking you now, doing this, the third incarnation of these figures, and having written a large number of comics over your lifetime, do you find that you have to consciously go, oh, I'm not redoing an old issue of, you know, Avengers or something like that? Is it difficult?
Well, of course, if you had an old issue of Avengers or something, you wouldn't, you would consciously avoid doing that. But, I mean, I've heard this from guys who work with me as far back as Marvel. I mean, I remember the editor who had Thor, I don't remember who it was, but I remember that the Thor sales were falling, and, you know, and I kept hearing this comment, not only from him, but from other people. Well, you know, Thor's been around so long, kind of everything's been done, it's, you know, the character's used up, there's nothing else can be done. Enter Walt Simonson. Next thing you know, there's Beta Ray Bill, and Thor's a frog, and all kinds of crazy stuff has happened. Baloney. There's always, I mean, to me, it's like things don't get used up. It's like a wave that propagates. You know, you keep it more opportunity. Yeah, sometimes you have to like think and kind of guard against. I'll give you a for instance. I had a scene in the Turok that I'm writing now. That I'm thinking it's so cool, you know. And then I realized I did something kind of vaguely similar in Magnus, you know, which I wrote only a few weeks earlier. I said, no. So I had to, like, sit down, think harder, come up with something, and I came up with something better. And that's how it usually works. If you don't get into that mindset where, well, you know, everything's been done, and you start thinking about the glass being, you know, like half empty in this case, you know, there's plenty of room to expand. And that's another good thing about being in the situation I am. He won't let me, you know, get stuck in the mud, and he's bigger than me, and I kick my ass. He won't let me.
I'm not bigger than him, and I cannot kick his ass.
No, he's all muscle. Trust me, he's all muscle. And these guys wouldn't settle for it. If I started doing stick in the mud stuff, they'd leave. You know, I mean, I think that the chance to, that we can, you know, with all of this talent and dedication, and, you know, what is that saying? It's 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. It's really true. I mean, I was interviewed in the Comic Buyer's Guide, I guess, and they said, you know, what do you think of your talent or something? I said, I'm not sure I have any. I just outwork the bastards. You know, I just stay up longer and research more and write more lists and figure stuff out. And you know, some gifted guys like Mark Waid, oh, yeah, sure. You know, it just comes. I don't know. But whatever, however you get there is fine. And in this company, you know, we're not going to, we won't fail for lack of trying.
Right. And Chris, I should say also that Chris, being a very talented artist himself, boy, does not let me get away with anything. And that's it's really forcing me to really, because he knows that I genuinely want this to be the best stuff that I've ever done and to be up to Jim's standards, both in terms of storytelling and to just the Herculean effort that he's really, I mean, if you see these scripts, I mean, the guy, he's really trying.
And most comic book scripts were like 20 pages or so. I've seen a lot of them. I've seen as few as like just under 3,000 words. The one you did for the Legion, they showed me that. Holy cow.
Yeah.
And then I've seen, you know, some of the writers, usually the better ones, you know, 8,000, 9,000 words. I think I'm up around 15 on average. 15,000 words. With lots of pictures. With lots of pictures.
And I also wanted to say that there's a very, to me, a very odd and interesting sort of dichotomy between sort of the instinct and the intellect when you work on something. I mean, like, I'm sure everybody here, especially the artists, I'm sure we've been in a situation where you drew something, you put a lot of effort in it, you think it's a good job, and then for whatever reason it gets destroyed, or now in the computer age something happens and Photoshop loses the file or whatever happens, and you're forced to do it again, and then you realize it's better. It's better because you've sort of, your brain has processed that experience, and now you're building on it. And I don't know who said it, but whoever, you know, was brilliant, that masterpieces they're not written, they're rewritten. Just the process of, you know, I sort of see that everything comes out of you sort of an instinctive way, and some people they're very wonderful natural talents, and they sort of get away with just, there's the birth, and they send it out into the world, and it works. And some of us have to work a little harder. But I find that regardless, no matter how good, to me, the whatever comes out of you instinctively is really going to be a mishmash of everything that you've seen your entire life.
I wouldn't use mishmash, but go ahead.
Well, combination. You know, it's a combination of everything that you've seen and heard and experienced and the art that you've seen. And I think that for most of the great artists that I really admire have talked about that necessary step of once you've got there it is, to sort of take that and move it around and sort of apply an intellect, and then that becomes part of your experience, and then that becomes instinctive, and it just, I think if you work hard at it, then if you're lucky, you get better and better, and I think that's essentially the process.
More questions? Funny stories, anyone?
Will you see like a Magnus Predator rematch? Or
I don't know, Mike.
Why not?
Will we see a Magnus Predator rematch?
Never know.
People want it.
Well, that's, you know, and again, you know, even when we've done those, you know, crossovers, it's always been, would this be fun? I mean, would this be something that someone would want to read? I mean, and even, I mean, us at Dark Horse, when we first, I mean, I was like, you know, I'm the first guy that said Aliens versus Predator, and we just all went like, yeah, of course. You know, I mean, someone else would have said it probably in 5 minutes.
And I'm the guy who plotted the first Magnus Predator, what was it, two-part story. And I didn't get to write it, but I wrote the story for it.
But yeah, I mean, if it's going to be fun and if it works, I mean, again, we're not sitting and trying to do financial calculus and everything. It's like this would be the perfect crossover. And even when you're building, you know, I wouldn't say a universe necessarily, but when you're building a line or where you're building, you know, these titles, you kind of don't want a tight fitting suit of clothes. I mean, you want it to be to grow organically, and stories that come out of it make sense, rather than having some kind of rigid battle plan of, you know, one title, then two, then four, then these crossovers, and you know, that's that has a tendency to. It's sort of like the more you do that, the more you confine the possibilities. And I think we just want these things to go where they're going to go, and you know, if crossing things over or team ups or whatever makes sense and will be fun, then we'll certainly look at it.
I think it works better that way, you know, eventually if your plan eventually is sort of to universe build, because I think of with the company that came out of Orlando,
CrossGen,
and for me, like, just anecdotally, for me, the problem was, like, when Jim did Valiant, I mean, the pieces sort of just came together very gradually, and then you began to see that there's a cohesive universe being formed, and then of course then Unity happened and everything explodes. But like, the problem with something like CrossGen as a reader for me when that stuff was coming out was that everything was so already set and self-contained. There's 10 titles coming out at once, and it just felt like, well, geez, if I didn't get in on the ground floor that first month and read all those titles, I'm not going to understand what the hell's going on. There's, like you said, Chris, there was no chance for there to be sort of an organic way to get into the story and watch it unfold rather than just say, blah, there it is. Look at this big, giant universe in your face.
I don't know about universe in your face. I don't know about cross-gen or whatever. But I mean, I try to approach...
I was just saying it as a reader.
No, I understand. I try to approach every comic book, and this is the cliche, I'm sorry, as if it were the first comic book anyone had ever read. And, you know, I've had people say, well, that means you have to make it simple and stupid, and you have to repeat the origin. And, no, you don't. No, you don't. The first Spider-Man I read was Spider-Man number 2. It didn't retell the origin. It just was cool, and it made you curious, and it worked. It was logical, but it didn't, you know, burden you with stuff you didn't need to know for that story. So I try to make it like anyone can pick up any book at any time, and I hope find it groovy. And then maybe then they're interested to go back and see if they can get back issues, which is a wonderful thing that can happen today. Couldn't happen when I was a kid. It was just newsstand. And, you know, so that's the goal, is to make any book you pick up at any time, make it rock, make it enough of a story so that you know, there's some substance to it. You don't just feel like you've read, you know, like a few pages of a chapter or something. And make it so that in every book there's a reason to care about these people, and a reason to want to know what happened to them before, and want to know what happened to them later, happens to them later, and you know that's the goal. You'll tell us, but that's where we're going. Top of the reading stack, our goal or bust.
All right, so we have just a couple minutes left here. I know some more people have come in since we first started here. How many retailers do we have in the audience right now?
A few.
So we have a few. Okay, so what I'm going to do, as most of you know, who've been attending the Retailer Summit, we actually are putting together a drawing for a giveaway of an original art piece by Chris Warner. And what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to go ahead, and since we have more business cards than we do retailers in the audience right now, I'm going to actually draw three names. And my hope is that by the time we get to the third name, that person will be sitting in this room right now, because I think that would be a much more special experience for everybody. So, first and foremost,
lovely
piece of solar artwork done by Chris Warner.
After Raymond Swanland. This is
yeah.
Long story, we won't get into it, but...
So,
Jim, would you like to do the honors of drawing a name?
Sure. Do I come over there? Or you bring them to me. That's lovely. Thanks. Taking a card from each of these guys and just picking.
Hey, why not?
That way we know they're here.
Anybody who's a retailer in the audience, bring a business card to the stage right now.
Stone, scissors, paper.
And we'll let somebody other than me do it, because I'm obviously bad luck.
Two cards. This is going to be hard.
All right, there's more. All right. There's more.
If they don't have a card, let them put a mark on one of the cards you have.
Perfect.
Anyone who doesn't have a card who's a retailer, come up, we'll give you a card. Seriously, we'll give you a card. Come on. Just put your name on here, or unless you have one.
I got a question. Can I give you my friend who is a retailer's card?
Sure.
Chris?
that announcement will be coming up. We're doing some business calculus on that, using marketing events to announce. Jim will be on the book.
Will be a third cover artist tour, one of the two gentlemen you mentioned before doing the
cover. That's still
okay.
TBD.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can almost say that. I can't quite.
Somebody else less unlucky than me.
All right. Who wants to draw the name? How about Chris? It's your piece of art.
Okay.
All right. Chris Warner, ladies and gentlemen.
Pass the artwork down to Bill. Dark Tower, Mark Beatty.
All right. Last minute entry.
Yeah, this is basically an ink drawing of the swan. It's actually the first swipe that I can remember doing. That and the Magnus one I did also.
All right.
So do we have a pen I can sign?
I have a Sharpie.
I thought it might be a little big for this.
I have a pen.
Sign on the back.
Let me take it.
It's an actual pen. Here, wait, test it on this.
Scribble it.
Okay. Okay, we're signing.
All right. So while we're signing this piece of art, I want to go ahead and take a moment to thank everybody for coming.
Just thank you.
For those of you who aren't aware, all of these exciting characters and books we've been talking about will show up for the first time ever on May 1st. At Free Comic Book Day. So, whether you're a retailer in the audience who will be hosting this event, or a patron of a retailer, please make sure to stop by your local retailer, really as often as possible, but definitely on Free Comic Book Day. And you'll get a chance to see this for the first time. And like every great thing, the first time is always free. So, we're hoping to get you hooked. But again, thank you all for being here, and thank you so much for supporting Dark Horse.
Thank you.
Thank you.